From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
J'ai entendu votre volonté de changement.
I have heard your will for change.
J'ai entendu votre
I have heard your strength,
votre espérance.
Your hope. And I want to express to you all of my gratitude.
Merci.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, people of France.
In a landmark victory in France, François Hollande becomes the first socialist to lead the country in 17 years. And in parliamentary elections in Greece, voters reject the two leading pro-austerity parties. Then hundreds of thousands of students in Quebec suspend the longest strike in the province's history. We'll go to Montreal. And finally, part two of our discussion with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Steve Cole on his new book, Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power.
What surprised me was the extent to which ExxonMobil really sees itself proudly as an independent sovereign, as its own government, in effect.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The growing anti-austerity movement in Europe received a big boost this weekend with the defeat of French President Nicolas Sarkozy and the defeat of Greece's two largest political parties. In France, François Hollande is set to become the first socialist to lead France since 1995.
Je suis le président de la jeunesse de France.
I am the president of the youth of France.
Je suis le président de toutes
I am the president of all the collective pride of France. I am the president of justice in France.
Portez loin ce message.
Carry this message far. Remember for the rest of your life this great gathering at the Bastille, because it must give a taste to other peoples, to the whole of Europe, of the change that is coming.
In Greece, anti-bailout parties placed first and second in Sunday's election, ousting Greece's ruling parties from power. The right-wing New Democracy Party won 19% of the vote. The coalition of the radical left placed second. One Greek analyst told the Financial Times, quote, there's a whole generational shift happening in just one night. We'll have more on Greece and France after headlines. The U.S. carried out drone strikes in Yemen and Pakistan over the weekend. In Yemen, a drone reportedly killed Fahd al-Qassah, who escaped from prison in 2005 after being convicted of a role in the 2000 bombing of the USS Cole warship in Yemen's port of Aden. In response to the drone strike, militants staged a surprise attack on a Yemeni army base earlier today, killing 20 soldiers and capturing 25 others. Meanwhile, in Pakistan, a U.S. drone fired two missiles at a compound in North Waziristan Saturday, killing at least 9 people. In news from Afghanistan, The Washington Post has revealed the United States has been secretly releasing Afghan prisoners as part of negotiations with militant groups. U.S. officials have reportedly used the prisoners as bargaining chips in violent areas. At Guantanamo, lawyers for 5 prisoners being tried by a military commission for their role in the September 11th attacks said the judicial process was rigged to lead to the execution of their clients. During Saturday's arraignment, the prisoners refused to talk or listen to the judge. One prisoner was brought to the court in restraints. A lawyer for one of the prisoners said the actions of the men was a, quote, peaceful resistance to an unjust system. Attorney James Harrington criticized the military commission's rules that barred discussion of the time of his client, Ramzi bin al-Shib, spent in a secret CIA prison.
Well, there are certain areas that are off limits for us, including questions about their confinement and questions about things that have happened to them in the past. And until there's some change in the rules that we operate under, we have severe constraints in exploring those issues. And they bear significantly on this case and the issues that ultimately will be litigated.
Army Brigadier General Mark Martins defended the military commission process.
Some have said that any attempt to seek accountability within the military commission system must inevitably be tainted by torture. To those who have these concerns, we say we acknowledge your skepticism, but we also say that the law prohibits the use of any statement obtained as the result of torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment and we will implement the law. These proceedings will be fair, and I submit that we military judge advocates who are carrying out assigned duties in this reform process have some standing to maintain that they will be fair.
One of Bahrain's most prominent human rights activists remains in jail after being detained Saturday. Nabil Rajab, who heads the Bahrain Center for Human Rights, was arrested when he returned from a trip to Lebanon. Rajab is being accused of taking part in and calling for an illegal gathering in March. He has been a frequent guest on Democracy Now! Over the past year. You can go to democracynow.org to see our interviews with him. For the first time since 1970, Japan has stopped producing nuclear power. Up until the partial nuclear meltdown at Fukushima last year, nuclear power plants provided almost 30% of Japan's electricity needs. A growing anti-nuclear movement in Japan has forced the closure of Japan's other plants. On Saturday, Japan shut down its last nuclear plant, but government officials have not ruled out restarting its nuclear industry if Japan suffers from electricity shortages. On Saturday, thousands of anti-nuclear activists marched, calling for the nuclear plants never to be reopened. One protester named Kaori Kanda said she was worried about the effects of radiation.
My friend in Iwaki just died of cardiac arrest. The people around me are dying. They are dying because they are staying in places where the radiation is too high, absorbing the fallout and dying of cardiac arrest. The cause and effect cannot be directly established, so we can only say what a pity. But there are so many people dying now.
Vice President Joe Biden says he's, quote, absolutely comfortable with same-sex marriage, a position that appears in contrast to that of President Obama, who's endorsed civil unions but not marriage for same-sex couples. Biden made the remark in an interview on Meet the Press with David Gregory.
You're comfortable with same-sex marriage now?
I am Vice President of the United States of America. The president sets the policy. I am absolutely comfortable with the fact that men marrying men, women marrying women, and heterosexual men and women marrying men are entitled to the same exact rights, all the civil liberties. And quite frankly, I don't see much of a distinction beyond that.
In a second term, will this administration come out behind same-sex marriage, the institution of marriage?
I can't speak to that. I don't know the answer to that.
The New York Times reports Vice President Biden's comments sent the White House scrambling to clarify that Biden was not articulating an official change in policy. Federal prosecutors have announced they will investigate last year's fatal police shooting of Kenneth Chamberlain, the 68-year-old former Marine who was shot dead inside his own apartment in White Plains, New York, after he accidentally set off his Life Aid medical alert. Last week, a Westchester grand jury declined to bring charges against any of the police officers involved in the incident. Chamberlain was African American. He was shot by a white police officer. Shortly before the shooting, another police officer referred to him using the N-word. Ellen Davis, a spokesperson for the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, said, quote, "We will review all of the available evidence with respect to the death of Kenneth Chamberlain, including the evidence collected during the state's investigation, to determine whether there were any violations of the federal criminal civil rights laws." The website CNET is reporting the FBI is asking internet companies not to oppose a controversial proposal that would require firms, including Microsoft, Facebook, Yahoo, and Google, to build in back doors for government surveillance. The FBI has drafted a proposed law that would require social networking websites and providers of instant messaging and web email alter their code to ensure their products are wiretap friendly. The legislation is reportedly one component of what the FBI has internally called the National Electronic Surveillance Strategy. 20 activists were convicted Friday of disorderly conduct for blocking a New York City police station door in October to protest the police department's stop-and-frisk policy. Defendants included Princeton University professor Cornel West. Most of the activists were sentenced to time served. The pioneering hip-hop artist Adam Yauch died Friday of cancer at the age of 47. Known by his nickname MCA, He was one-third of the legendary Beastie Boys. He was a practicing Buddhist and helped organize the Tibetan Freedom Concert. In 1998, he made headlines when he publicly criticized the Clinton administration's bombing of Iraq at the Video Music Awards.
A rare opportunity that one gets to speak to this many people at once. So if you guys will forgive me, I just wanted to speak my mind on a couple things. And I think it was a real mistake that the U.S. chose to fire missiles into the Middle East. I think that was a huge mistake. And I think that it's very important that the United States start to look towards nonviolent means of resolving conflicts. Because if we... Hold on. Give me one second here. Because if we... Those bombings that took place in the Middle East were thought of as a retaliation by the terrorists. And if we thought of what we did as retaliation, certainly we're going to find more retaliation from people in the Middle East, from terrorists specifically, I should say, because most Middle Eastern people are not terrorists. And I think that's another thing that America really needs to think about is our racism. Racism that comes from the United States towards Muslim people and towards Arabic people. And that's something that has to stop. And the United States has to start respecting people from the Middle East in order to find a solution to the problem that's been building up over many years. So I thank everyone for your patience in letting me speak my mind on that.
Adam Yauch of the Beastie Boys speaking in 1998. MCA was 47 years old. And finally, on Saturday, the day of the supermoon, the longest moon of the year, Sarah Sheward and Shane Bauer got married near Half Moon Bay in California. They're the U.S. hikers who were imprisoned by Iran, Sarah for 14 months, Shane for more than 2 years. Shane proposed to Sarah in the Evian prison by tying a thread from his shirt around her finger in the prison yard during one of their brief daily meetings. Josh Fatale, the third U.S. hiker who was jailed with Shane, was the best man. Among those who attended was Swiss diplomat Livia Liu, the Swiss ambassador to Iran who represents U.S. interests in Iran and helped negotiate the hikers' release. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In France's landmark presidential election, François Hollande has defeated incumbent Nicolas Sarkozy, making him the first socialist in 17 years to lead Europe's second-biggest economy. Hollande soared to power on an anti-austerity platform in the midst of the euro crisis, demanding a European Union treaty limiting debt be expanded to include measures to produce economic growth. During his campaign, he proposed special taxes on banks and oil companies, as well as a 75% tax on those earning over €1 million— roughly 1.3 million U.S. dollars annually. Hollande's victory was narrow but uncontested. Official results showed him with 51.6% of the vote, while Sarkozy had just over 48%. He's the first socialist to win the French presidency since François Mitterrand in the 1980s. Hollande gave his victory speech in his stronghold of Toul in central France Sunday.
Je ne sais pas si vous m'entendez.
I don't know if you can hear me.
Mais moi, je vous ai entendu.
But I have heard you.
J'ai entendu votre volonté de changement.
I have heard your will for change. I have heard your strength, your hope, and I want to express to you all of my gratitude.
Je veux vous exprimer toute ma gratitude. Merci. Merci.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, people of France, gathered here to have allowed me to be your president of the Republic.
As François Hollande headed to Paris, he addressed supporters at the Place de la Bastille, a traditional rallying point of the left. His jubilant supporters gathered to celebrate, drinking champagne, chanting, Sarko, it's over. This is Arnaud Montebourg, a member of France's Socialist Party.
I believe that he is laying the groundwork for more than just the alternative, with a lot of emotion. It is history. It hasn't happened for a socialist president for 24 years. It is possible, the French say it, to not accept the fatality of the financial markets, of deregulated finance, of unlimited globalization.
The newly elected Hollande also campaigned on a promise to pull France's troops from Afghanistan by the end of the year, 2 years ahead of the planned U.S. withdrawal. He's set to meet with NATO leaders at their summit in Chicago later this month, where the focus will be on Afghanistan. Meanwhile, incumbent Nicolas Sarkozy called Hollande to congratulate him on winning. Sarkozy accepted his defeat and urged supporters to accept the new leader of France.
Le peuple français a fait son
Dear compatriots,
The French people have made their choice. If you trust me, I ask you to listen to what I have to tell you. I have thought about it a lot. France has a new president of the Republic. It is a democratic choice, Republican.
Meanwhile, in Greece, voters sent their own message against austerity Sunday during the country's parliamentary elections. The two main parties that had pledged to enact harsh international bailouts suffered significant losses at the polls. Voters rejected the governing parties in favor of far-left and far-right parties that have both opposed budget cuts. Left coalition leader Alexis Tsipras said he wanted to form a left-wing coalition rejecting the terms of Greece's bailouts.
We are sure that the Greek people will send a strong message to all of Europe for a change of course. There is no room for the barbaric bailout agreement in our European course.
Meanwhile, Greece's neo-Nazi Golden Dawn Party could enter parliament for the first time if their tally of almost 7% holds up. The party had pledged to, quote, clean up Greece by expelling all legal and illegal immigrants. The group, which openly displays books on Aryan supremacy at its party offices, has been frequently linked to racist attacks, but denies beating up migrants. For more on the changing face of Europe, we're joined now by Yanis Varoufakis. He is a professor of economic theory at the University of Athens in Greece. Yanis Varoufakis, welcome to Democracy Now! Let's begin in France, the significance of Hollande's victory.
It is a culmination of a cascade. Recall that 2 years ago, the euro crisis began, and it is the economy, stupid. In exactly the same way that you had a domino effect, toppling effectively states, beginning with Greece, then we went to Ireland. Those states became insolvent, went bankrupt. Then we moved to Portugal, then we moved to Spain, and we keep moving. We are moving to Italy, and at some point we'll come to France. At the same time, there was a cascade of collapses of governments. It began in Ireland, then we moved to Portugal. All those governments fell. Yesterday, we had another two governments that fell. One was the government of Mr. Sarkozy. France is going to be the battleground for the euro. And the failure of the eurozone to react rationally and efficiently to this crisis was the undoing of Mr. Sarkozy. What happened in Greece was not just a change of government. It was a political implosion, the implosion of a whole regime.
In terms of Hollande, tell us his story. How did he come to lead the Socialist Party and become the new president of France?
Hollande rose almost by default. The Socialists are a fragmented party. They're fractious. They've had a long history after their titular head, François Mitterrand, the only Socialist ever to have been elected president, passed away. The Socialists actually never got on with one another. And you will recall that in the last presidential election, the one that Mr. Sarkozy won, it was Ségolène Royal, who is the ex-partner of Mr. Hollande, that stood against Sarkozy. Mr. Hollande was not particularly loyal to her in that election. I think he actually undermined her. They have four children amongst themselves, but they couldn't actually get it together with that election. This time around, he didn't get much support from her or from the Socialist Party. It was the collapse of the legitimacy of the austerity policies of Mr. Sarkozy that effectively handed Mr. Hollande the presidency of the Republic. So this is not a pro-Hollande vote. It's an anti-Sarkozy vote.
At a mass rally in January, Hollande decried the world of finance as it currently functions.
Mon véritable adversaire. Il n'a pas de nom.
My real enemy doesn't have a name or a face or a party. He'll never run as president, and so he'll never be elected, although he does govern.
Il gouverne. Cet adversaire,
my enemy is the world of finance.
After winning a first-place position in the first-round presidential ballot, Hollande told journalists if he was elected, quote, there will be no more free trade and unlimited competition. What does that mean?
It means that there was a jostling for position between Sarkozy and Hollande, because if you read the speeches of Mr. Sarkozy, he was also waging supposedly war against the world of Anglo-American finance. French politics is replete with such rhetoric. In essence, I don't think there's going to be much of a difference. Mr. Hollande is, as of today, heavily constrained by the Central Bank of France, which is surely going to be onto him with words of caution about what the French president must do to retain the trust of the markets. And you will see a different Mr. Hollande. If you recall, François Mitterrand, the first president that came from the socialist camp, was elected in the early 80s on the basis of an almost Marxist platform. Within a year or so, he had become effectively a Thatcherite. I don't expect to see much of a difference from Hollande, but the significance of Hollande is that it's like a seed being planted in the foundations of the Eurozone, which hopefully will flourish, and the result will be an end to the idiocy which passes as economic policy in the Eurozone at the moment.
Professor Varoufakis, let's move to Greece. What happened?
Greece is going through its Great Depression, something akin to what the United States went through in the 1930s. This is not just a change of government. It's a social economy that has entered into a deep coma. It's a country that is effectively verging to the status of a failed state. Greece is going through an existentialist crisis. And just look at the numbers. The Socialist Party had 44% of the vote only two short years ago. They went down to 13%. The opposition conservatives, they were at a low tide mark of 35%, 35% in 2009. They would have been in opposition. They should be picking up votes. They went down below 20%. The political class of Greece, effectively, has been thrown out by the electorate. This is very exciting and very worrying at the same time. The rise of the Nazis is something to be lamented.
The Guardian reports today Greek TV channels are reporting the country's electoral earthquake has been met with stunned silence by officials at the International Monetary Fund in Washington.
It's their week of discontent, because for the second time around, the International Monetary Fund has fomented, first time was in Latin America and perhaps Southeast Asia in the late 1990s, now it's the second time their policies and their heavy-handed approach to a failing economy has created a spectacular failure in their own hands.
Meanwhile, Greek conservative leader Antonis Samaras said Sunday he's ready to try to form a national salvation government and appeal to pro-European parties to join him.
Είμαστε έτοιμοι. We
are ready to take the responsibility of the formation of the government of national salvation, with two specific aspirations, that the country remain in the euro, and the amendment of the policies of the bailout agreement so that there is growth and relief in Greek society. Today I submit this open proposal towards all the parties that accept the European course of the country and the need for a change of economic policy. I understand the rage of the people, but our party will not leave Greece ungoverned.
Frenzied attempt by the powers that be in Europe to convince Mr. Samaras, the leader of the Conservative Party, the leader of the Socialists, the fragmented and heavily defeated Socialists, and the leader of one of the small left-wing parties to forge a coalition in order to continue business as usual regarding the implementation of the austerity plan. Now, in other words, following the election, we are now going to be witnesses to a wholesale attempt by the European leadership in Brussels, in Frankfurt, in Berlin, to ensure that the popular will in Greece is subverted and that austerity continues, possibly dressed up by means of some nice anti-austerity rhetoric, when in reality the policies don't change.
You mentioned the Nazi Party in Greece, the rise of it, and also in France you have Marie Le Pen, although she didn't win, certainly rising in popularity.
The ultra-right does not need to win in order to gain power. The fact that they are rising in influence on the streets and in parliament is sufficient to inflict a major blow on democracy, to color the whole complexion of democracy. Let me give you a very simple example. Only 2 weeks ago, the Socialist Minister of Public Order introduced compulsory HIV tests on paperless migrant prostitutes, which were carried out by means of force, police brutality, and then their photographs were published in newspapers and on websites, official government websites. And all that was in order to demonstrate that you don't need to elect Nazis if you can elect me. Okay. When Nazis manage to influence the agenda in that way, they don't need to be in government.
The ultranationalist far-right Golden Dawn says it'll start by forcing immigrants out of Greece after exit polls show it would pass into parliament for the first time since the end of a military dictatorship in 1974.
What will be the first measure to change?
All the illegal immigration out! Out of my country! Out of my home!
So he wants legal and illegal immigrants, Golden Dawn.
He wants a Kristallnacht against anyone that doesn't look Greek, whatever that means.
Final comments on the significance of the elections in Greece and France.
It just goes to show that just like after 1929, when you start with a Wall Street collapse, which then spreads throughout the breadth and width of the world capitalist economies, similarly after 2008, we have an economic crisis that shook the foundations of the Eurozone. The Eurozone was never designed to sustain such a great financial crisis. And the Eurozone now is unraveling. The political class, just like in the 1930s, has failed spectacularly to mount a response to this economic crisis. And now there is a political implosion. Whether the fragmented opposition to the idiocy which passes as economic policy in Europe is going to find a common voice in order to stop the rot and put an end to the rise of the Nazis is something that we're going to have to wait and see.
Yanis Varoufakis, I want to thank you very much for being with us, professor of economic theory at the University of Athens in Greece. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, part two of our conversation with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Steve Kohl on ExxonMobil and American power. Stay with us.
We're reaching a point where we can't turn back. Let's lose the guns or let's lose the bombs. What's up? Now, how many people must get killed
for oil families' pockets to get filled?
How many oil families get killed?
Not a damn one, so what's the deal?
It's time to lead the way and de-escalate. Lose the weapons of mass destruction and the hate. Say, ooh, ah, what's the White House doing?
In a world gone mad by the Beastie Boys, on Friday, the pioneering hip-hop group lost one of its members. MCA died of cancer at the age of 47. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to part two of my interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Steve Kohl, his most exhaustive book, Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power, pulls back the curtain on one of the largest and most powerful corporations in the country. He calls it a corporate state within the American state. Earlier today, Fortune magazine announced ExxonMobil had topped its Fortune 500 list for 2012, beating out Walmart. Steve Kohl is president of the New America Foundation, a staff writer at The New Yorker. Previously, he was managing editor of The Washington Post and has also been a reporter, foreign correspondent, and editor at The Post. He was awarded his second Pulitzer Prize for his book Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden from the Soviet Invasion to September 10, 2001. Also author of the book The Bin Ladens, an Arabian Family in the American Century. We spoke to Steve Kohl, Juan Gonzalez and I, on Friday. You can see part one of our interview at our website, democracynow.org. Here, we began by asking about the controversial role ExxonMobil has played in Indonesia as it operated lucrative gas fields amidst a bloody war for independence.
During this contest, the big prize, the source of the greatest wealth in the Achenese economy, was this large gas field and related manufacturing facilities, first owned by Mobil. And then Exxon acquired it when they merged with Mobil in 2000. Now, under this set of arrangements, the Indonesian forces that were spread out around the perimeter of this gas field were paid for—their salaries were paid by ExxonMobil. And what the emails from the lawsuit show is that there was quite a lot of interaction from day to day, ExxonMobil's security officers on the ground and the commanders of these forces. And I was able to interview, you know, different individuals involved in that. And there was a much closer relationship between ExxonMobil and the forces than the corporation had previously described. I think the documents make that clear. The other thing that happened was that the guerrilla forces started to conclude, for the reasons that you described earlier, the use of these excavation, these bulldozers to dig graves, the persistence of torture and detention right on the perimeter of the gas fields that ExxonMobil owned, the fact that the Indonesians set up these detention centers right on the fence, and I was able to look at them when I traveled there and talk to victims. The guerrillas basically concluded that ExxonMobil was on the other side of the war, so they started attacking the corporation's facilities. That brought the Bush administration into the picture. And these State Department cables that came out through this Freedom of Information Act request for the book show that the Bush administration basically went to the guerrillas in 2001 and said, you know, we have terrorism lists that apply to people like you, and we would urge you to stop targeting ExxonMobil. Otherwise, you're going to go on our list as a global terrorist organization. And there's the chapter that describes all this is drawn from a quotation from a contemporaneous State Department cable in which a Bush administration diplomat says to the guerrilla leaders, do you really want us as an enemy? And ultimately, the guerrillas said, okay, we'll stop shooting at ExxonMobil and carry on our war by other means.
Steve Cole, you also have a chapter in your book, Can't the CIA and the Navy Solve This Problem? And it's referring to ExxonMobil's involvement in Nigeria. Now, we've often reported here on Democracy Now! On Chevron in Nigeria, but what about ExxonMobil?
Well, they're there. They're in a somewhat more favorable position from a company's point of view than Chevron and Shell, because their oil is offshore in deep water, and the facilities they have in the Delta are less intrusive and less spread out than those of Chevron and Shell. But I went down to visit them in Akwaibom State and talked to local community leaders and political leaders in the Delta. And they have as much of a struggle winning, you know, support from ExxonMobil for their development goals as is the case in River State and Delta State nearby. But what actually happened in 2008 was that the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta, which is this somewhat shadowy guerrilla group that has attacked oil companies there, started to target ExxonMobil. They acquired speedboats and were going out to these offshore platforms and attacking the company's facilities. And the corporation, having been chastened by the experience in Indonesia and Aceh and not wanting another lawsuit, had finally, very late, signed up for corporate responsibility practices in which they promise not to shoot at people, you know, except in the most extreme circumstances. And so they were implementing this new regime, but they weren't quite sure how to handle the fact that they were being attacked again and again. So essentially, they contacted the Bush administration again in 2008 and said, that's where the quote comes from, can't the CIA and the Navy solve this problem? The United States has already created a new military command based in Germany for Africa. And there were efforts to try to see if the U.S. military could address this problem for them.
In late February, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments on whether corporations can be sued in U.S. courts for human rights abuses committed overseas. That case is called Cobell versus Royal Dutch Shell. Democracy Now! Spoke to Marco Simons, legal director of Earth Rights International, who explained its significance.
This case is really about whether a corporation that participates in serious human rights abuses, such as crimes against humanity or genocide or state-sponsored torture, can profit from those abuses and shield those profits from the victims when the victims come to take them to court. It's essentially about whether corporations are immune from any kind of liability for serious human rights abuses worldwide. And that's what the Court of Appeals held in this case. They said, under no circumstances can a corporation ever be sued for the most serious human rights violations today.
That's Marco Simons, legal director of Earth Rights International. Steve Cole, this issue of corporations being sued for human rights abuses.
Well, some human rights lawyers in the Aceh case have been remarkably persistent and skillful in keeping their clients in the game. I mean, it's almost like a Dickens novel. The suit was filed in 2000. It's still going on. It hasn't come close to reaching trial because ExxonMobil has appealed and appealed. And while at some stages they've won, the lawyers for the victims in Aceh have stayed with it and have kept it going. It's back in play. Now, in the 12 years since it was filed, a couple of the plaintiffs, the victims, have died of old age. And it's not clear whether this case will go to trial. But what is impressive is the extent to which different judges from, you know, appointed by different presidents from different orientations have refused to basically accept the idea that no one should be held accountable. And they have kept this question that your previous speaker illuminated. They've kept it alive in the court, so there's still some hope that there will be accountability.
Steve Cole, what about ExxonMobil's involvement in Chad?
So this is a fascinating story. Chad, of course, is a benighted country. Today, about 181st out of 187 countries in the Human Development Index kept by the United Nations, indicating quality of life. Life expectancy there is still below 50 years, but it has oil. And its authoritarian leader, to put it politely, Idris Deby, decided to try to develop this oil, even though Chad was landlocked and didn't have any national capacity to build an oil company. So they invited in Exxon and the World Bank, and they undertook this experiment, really without precedent, to require Chad to use its oil profits for the good of its people, spending on education, health and social development. And Exxon was a participant in this and described it as a potentially a new model to address the resource curse in Africa, where countries that are rich in minerals but try to develop through the sale of those minerals often fail to serve their people very well. So this was a kind of a grand experiment, and it failed. It failed in 2006 when Deby decided that he needed more guns to fend off rebels who were challenging his regime. And what the book describes, again, through State Department documents and others that came out during the research, was that the reason Deby was able to get out of this deal that he had made, promises that he had made to use oil money to serve his people, was that oil prices rose and ExxonMobil came to him and said, we're about to pay you more than $500 million a year in taxes because we're now in the money. And you can use that money to get out of your World Bank agreements and free yourself from these onerous requirements that you spend your money on health and education. And that's what happened. And in fact, in this case, ExxonMobil fought with the Bush administration, which wanted this deal to remain in place. And ExxonMobil basically, without calling any attention to itself, provided the means for Deby to abandon the agreement.
I want to go to Afghanistan, and you have been covering this even beyond this remarkable tome you have written, Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power, with your previous books. But earlier this week in Afghanistan, several large explosions rocked Kabul, hours after President Obama's surprise visit on the one-year anniversary of the U.S. killing of Osama bin Laden. The suicide attacks were claimed by the Taliban and resulted in at least seven deaths, numerous wounded. During his brief visit, President Obama delivered a prime-time address to the American people from Bagram Air Base. Obama signed an agreement with President Karzai on future Afghan-U.S. relations in Kabul, ahead of the NATO summit in Chicago later this month.
Good evening from Bagram Air Base. This outpost is more than 7,000 miles from home, but for over a decade, it's been close to our hearts. Because here, in Afghanistan, more than 500,000 of our sons and daughters have sacrificed to protect our country. Today, I signed a historic agreement between the United States and Afghanistan that defines a new kind of relationship between our countries, a future in which Afghans are responsible for the security of their nation, and we build an equal partnership between two sovereign states, a future in which war ends and a new chapter begins.
That's President Obama. Steve Cole, the significance of oil and the Afghan war, and also the significance of this time in Afghanistan, still the longest war in U.S. history.
Well, it's a very fragile time, and that speech was obviously directed at American audiences as much as anybody else, and part of the sort of exploitation of the anniversary of the Osama bin Laden killing by by politicians looking, you know, to be reelected. I think the problem with the war is that there's this increasing divergence between public speeches like that one, conferences, international conferences, declarations that the war is going well and that we're going to get there, and the facts on the ground. This has been a tough couple of years in Afghanistan, and the trend lines in local districts and provinces, when I travel, I find to be unfavorable. I think the basic assumptions of the policy in Afghanistan, that the Afghan armed forces can hold together, that there can be a stable political transition in Kabul after President Karzai's term ends in 2014, that the international community can reduce its presence without causing another round of civil war. All of these assumptions look quite shaky to me on the ground, I'm afraid. And so I find it very discouraging when public officials, you know, talk at one level of 40,000-foot confidence and sort of a series of abstract statements, when in our system, whatever our weaknesses, you'd think we'd stop lying to ourselves about the facts and at least grapple with even unpleasant facts. And what worries me most about this war right now is the gap between what the truth on the ground looks like and what our decision makers say in public.
Steve Cole, to get back to ExxonMobil, as you say, this is one of the largest and most profitable corporations in the history of the United States. Yet, compared to several of the other corporations, a Walmart, an Apple, a Microsoft, they get very little attention or very little coverage in the press generally, other than the business pages. Why is that?
Well, it's because that's their policy, and they're very good at carrying it out. I mean, their public affairs policy, even they joke, is to say no comment in 50 different languages. It's their business strategy to keep a low profile. And when you think about the kinds of partnerships that they're engaged in on the ground overseas in places like Chad or Equatorial Guinea or in Aceh, you can understand why they'd like to keep a low profile. It's in their interests, is the way they would put it. I found them as a journalist. You know, I've been reporting on governments and corporations for a long time now, and I'm used to public affairs strategies and to hard targets and to corporations or subjects that don't want you to write about them. I would say that ExxonMobil was about the hardest target I have ever taken on, not only because of their resistance to journalism or scrutiny by public groups, but also they're just very disciplined, and they're very well-funded. And so when they start going in a direction such as the media strategy they have, they have the resources to really push. And so anyway, it's an invisible company because it wants to be invisible.
Steve Cole, talk about the God Pod at the corporate headquarters in Irving, Texas. And also, you spend a great deal of time looking at Lee Raymond, the former ExxonMobil chief executive, a close relationship with Dick Cheney, and what all this means, what you were most surprised by in writing Private Empire.
Yeah, so I think the thing that surprised me most—I mean, the God Pod is a reference to their corporate headquarters, which is just on a kind of bland campus outside the Dallas-Fort Worth airport, and it's the worldwide headquarters of ExxonMobil. It's a relatively small group that works there, but a very elite group, and it has this kind of sort of slightly empty and eerie feel inside. The halls echo, and it's a very formal place. It almost feels like a Hollywood version of what the corporate headquarters of a worldwide corporation like ExxonMobil would be like. But I think, to answer your question about what was surprising, you know, I sort of assumed that the relationship between ExxonMobil and the United States government would be more complicated than I thought, or that it wouldn't be easy to just sort of describe it in one sentence. But what surprised me was the extent to which ExxonMobil really sees itself proudly as an independent sovereign, as its own government, in effect, and that it has its own foreign policies, its own economic policies. And I came to sort of think of them as sort of like France, in the sense that they were aligned with the United States sometimes, they were opposed other times, but mostly they were just trying to run their own global system without necessarily worrying too much about what the government in Washington wanted. But the exception to that was the very personal relationship between Lee Raymond, the chairman of ExxonMobil, and Dick Cheney, the vice president. They were friends and neighbors in Dallas before Cheney went to Washington. When Cheney ran Halliburton and Raymond ran ExxonMobil, they were business partners. But more important, they were, you know, hunting friends, and they came from a similar background in the Midwest, and they sort of saw the world. They had the same kind of outlook on the world. And so when Cheney was in Washington, Raymond had his own channel to the U.S. government that was very efficient. He found lobbying at the State Department or going through the bureaucracy very frustrating. He tried to stay away, and he could afford to stay away because he had a one-call relationship with the vice president where they could exchange views about what was happening in the world. And on occasion, he asked Cheney to intervene to support ExxonMobil's, you know, oil deal-making in the Middle East.
And talk to us about ExxonMobil's bet or involvement in fracking.
Right. So it's a big issue for them. In 2010, they bought the largest natural gas company engaged in fracking in the United States, a company called XTO. They spent $40 billion to buy them. And in doing so, they've made a very important turn toward the development of natural gas in the United States, and particularly gas that has to be extracted through these unconventional techniques referred to as fracking, basically fracturing rocks in order to free up relatively small pockets of gas and bring them out of the ground. What's interesting about this, I mean, obviously, you know, there's a lot of attention to fracking across the industry. ExxonMobil, A, is now the biggest player in the industry. B, is very focused on trying to control the regulatory regime that's now emerging, and there's a lot of dispute and argument about whether the regulation should be overseen by the federal government, the EPA, which is, you know, probably the toughest regulator we have, or whether it should be distributed around states and local communities where power is more diffuse and there's less expertise. So ExxonMobil is lobbying very busily to try to shape this regime. But, you know, in the long run, they have this self-limiting habit of undermining their own kind of radicalism about government regulation sometimes. I think climate was an example where they took such an extreme tact. They did a lot of damage, but they also ended up exposing themselves. And this is the sort of next generation challenge to them. Can they get out of their own way as they try to shape this fracking regime, or are they going to end up becoming sort of, you know, poster child of popular doubts about fracking?
Finally, Steve Cole, as we wrap up, we want to go back to where we started. You had excerpted a piece in The New Yorker from Private Empire about GOP politics and ExxonMobil. If you can talk once again about the significance of Exxon's role now in this election year and the power that it has in Washington, D.C.
Well, we talked about their Washington office, which is one of the most influential corporate lobbying offices in town over on K Street, and about how their political action committee contributions are so heavily directed to one side of the aisle, to the Republican Party. And as some of the reporting you put on the air, as we've talked, showed, you know, this is another election, as 2008 won, was, where the power of oil companies, and ExxonMobil in particularly, is actually an explicit subject of the campaign. It's pretty unusual to have the president of the United States calling out a corporation by name and calling out its profits and questioning, in effect, the legitimacy of those profits. Now, that shows that this contest is really serious. And I think ExxonMobil has the same attitude. The president and the Democratic Party, for their part, are well aware that ExxonMobil is really quite unusual among corporations in the way that it has allowed its political action committee spending to be identified solely with the Republican Party. So that also emboldens them to, you know, to go out and really speak directly about these issues. So I think the good part of it is that we may get, during this campaign, a more direct argument about the power of big oil in the United States and what it means to ordinary families, commuters, and you know, working families that really don't have any choice but to go to the pump and fill up their trucks or their cars as they go to work. They can't control the price, and they end up, in effect, getting taxed in a very indirect way without the government ever passing a bill.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Steve Cole. His most recent book is called Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power, pulling back the curtain on one of the largest and most powerful corporations in the United States, ExxonMobil. If you'd like to see part one of our conversation, go to our website at democracynow.org. When we come back, the mass student strike, the largest in Quebec's history in Canada, has been suspended. We'll go to one of the leading student organizers. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we turn now to Canada, where students in the province of Quebec have reached a tentative deal with the government over proposed tuition hikes. The deal puts an end to nearly 3 months of a class boycott by hundreds of thousands of students and the longest student strike in the province's history. Students in Quebec pay the lowest post-secondary education tuition in Canada, and the provincial government's plan would raise tuition by 75% over 5 years. The agreement, reached after 22 hours of negotiations between student leaders and the government, includes the government's tuition increase, but also calls for the creation of a provisional council that would review spending by universities and could reduce fees students pay on top of their tuition. Under the tentative deal, universities would decrease administrative fees to offset the increase in tuition fees. Student leaders say they're refusing to recommend the deal to their membership. Students across Quebec will cast their vote on the agreement this week. During the May Day protests in New York last week, Democracy Now! Spoke to Lily Schwartzbaum, a student at McGill University in Montreal, about the strike.
For the states to look at Quebec as a model as to what people should be fighting for. Often people say of Quebec, oh, it's only like 1625, like you should really pay your dues. And it's like, no, the rest of you are getting screwed. Like, you should think about what we're fighting for. And I think it's really important for North America, for Anglophone North America, to take this issue seriously.
To talk more about the student strikes and the agreement proposed this weekend, we go to Montreal, which has seen more than 200 student protests in the last 80 days. We're joined by Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois, the spokesperson for CLASS, the main coalition of student unions involved in the Quebec student strikes, and by Democracy Now! Video stream, Evelyn Couturier is joining us from IRIS, which is an institute of socioeconomic research. We begin with Gabrielle. Tell us about this strike, the significance of it.
Well, it is a very long strike. In fact, it is the biggest strike in Quebec history, which has a very big history of a student strike. We're talking about a strike of 13 weeks starting today, a strike who at the biggest was held by 300,000 Quebec post-secondary students. At the moment, we are at 170,000 people in strike in our province here. So it's really an historical mobilization, an unprecedented mobilization by the Quebec students on the specific issue of tuition fees. The Liberal government here decided to increase the tuition fees by 75% starting next year and over 5 years. And the mobilization really started about this specific issue. But after a few weeks of strike, we have saw unions, community groups, women groups entering in the movement. And now what we are what we are seeing here in Quebec is what people call the maple spring, the printemps érable in French. So it's really a mobilization that is starting to be more and more general and to address more than the specific issue of tuition fees, but also the general direction that is taking Quebec since the Liberal Party here came to power in 2003.
So for 3 months, students have not gone to school?
Well, it's not all the students of Quebec who are in strike, but a critical number of students are in strike. Yes, since now 3 months, it's even for Quebec, it's a unprecedented strike in terms of duration and in terms of popularity. So it's really a movement that no one really saw coming before it was a reality. So yeah, it's students from university and colleges all over the province who are in strike, so who are not going to their classes for 3 months now.
And the significance of the deal that was reached this weekend?
Well, it's a very complicated deal. First, the government decided to continue to increase tuition fees, but for the first semester, they decided to reduce the administrative fees of the universities at the same level of the increasing of tuition fees. So So generally, the student bill won't go up next semester. But what is particular in this offer is that the government accepted to put to fund a provisory committee of 19 persons, on which four will be students, and this committee will have the role to look at the expenses, sorry, of our universities to find out money that could be cut in order to invest this money in the reduction of the administrative fees of the universities. But so basically what the government is asking us is to abandon our strike in the hands of a provisory committee on which we will be minoritary. So it's a deal that is already that is already provoking a lot of hesitation in the students' assemblies.
Evelyne Couturier, can you talk about how college costs in Quebec compare with the rest of Canada and the United States and the significance of this strike?
Well, of course, in Quebec, the student fees are less high than in the rest of Canada. But then again, you have to compare with the whole picture, not only in North America, but in the whole developed countries. And then the students' fees in Quebec are much higher than the majority of the countries. So, and you also have to remember that when you talk about tuition fees, there's also a debt that is associated with that. So students who go to school have to pay a lot of things. It costs a lot. And the average debt in Quebec is also lower than in, let's say, Ontario. And hiking the fees, hiking the tuition, will mean to put the burden of the debt more and more on the shoulders of the students.
And the significance of this settlement, Evelyne, we just have 20 seconds.
Oh, well, I would say the burden of the proof is on the students. And that means a lot of things, because even though the students prove that there's a problem in the financing of universities, the government will decide to implement or not the cuts to refund the universities.
Well, Evelyne Couturier, I want to thank you for being with us, and Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois, spokesperson for CLASS, the main coalition of student unions involved in the student strikes in Quebec. We will report on what the students vote this week. That does it for the broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Fels-Aramonte, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Rabbi Karen, Dina Desder, Chantal Berman, Nancy Khan, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.